You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 232 by Rudolf Steiner, 14 lectures entitled Mystery Knowledge and Mystery Centers, revised translation by Pauline Werle. This is Lecture 12, entitled The Mysteries of the Samothracian Kabiroi. During the past weeks, I have been lecturing on many forms of the mysteries. We have been trying to gain insights, more especially into those mysteries, which in a certain sense were the last of the great mysteries connecting the inner life of the human being directly with nature, with the spirit of nature existence. These were the mysteries of Hibernia. And we have seen how through insight into human nature itself, through insight of an altogether intimate spiritual kind, individual and personal, the Greek mysteries penetrated into the inner nature of the human being. One may indeed say, just as in outer nature, various regions of the earth bear various kinds of vegetation, so in the course of human evolution, there is evidence of the most manifold influences working from the spiritual worlds onto human beings in the different regions of the earth. If we were now to proceed eastward, as we shall be doing in the course of the next few days, in our study of historical connections, we should find there many other forms of the mysteries. Today, however, since our visitors are not all here yet, I shall not start on something new, but add to what we have already been considering. Looking back on the evolution of humanity, a threefold development appears quite clearly to the imaginative consciousness. I say clearly to the imaginative consciousness, for if we were to extend further and further into the past, the epochs of which I am about to speak, we should, of course, arrive at a greater number than three. And it would be similar if we were to penetrate further and further into the future. Today, however, we will take for our study those middle stages of the evolution of humanity which do not appear only to inspiration, but quite clearly already on the imaginative level. We will consider them today from a particular standpoint. As late as the Egyptian epoch, humanity was still at the stage when, for the European African peoples, as well as for the Asian peoples, there was for human consciousness no such thing as what we call matter. There was not even any external coarse substance of any kind as far as human consciousness was concerned, much less those abstractions which we now call carbon, hydrogen, sulfur, and so on. There were none of these things. Everything in outer nature was seen directly as the embodiment of divine spiritual beings, manifesting throughout the whole of nature. If nowadays we go into the hills and pick up a stone, we look upon it as a substance like any other. Nothing at all comes into our awareness, such as came into the awareness of the ancient Egyptian or ancient Oriental. If nowadays we observe a human being and touch one of his fingers, we do not consider this human finger to be an object just like any other. We regard it as belonging to the human organism as a whole. If we were to look, for example, at the last joint of the index finger, we could not do otherwise than to speak of it as a part of the whole organism. That is how it was for the consciousness of the ancient Egyptians and the ancient Orientals. If they came upon a stone and picked it up, it was not for them merely a stone, as it would be for us today. They did not think of it as ordinary earthly substance at all. It was a part of the divine body, which the earth appeared to them to be. People of those olden times regarded the outer surface of the earth just as we in our consciousness regard the human skin. If we meet a person today and become aware that he or she reminds us of someone else we already know, but who is not present, and if it afterward transpires that the person we have met is the brother or sister of the other person, then it immediately comes to our mind that the two of them are of the same flesh and blood. They have certain physical connections with one another. When the ancient Greek or ancient Oriental raised his eyes to Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, and then looked down to the earth, he saw the earth as the divine body of the earth god, but at the same time as the sister or brother of the planets. In short, he saw a family likeness to the planets revolving around the earth, to Jupiter, Mars, and Saturn. Thus, in their perception of the cosmos as a whole, and in their perception of the earth as part of the cosmos, these ancient peoples were definitely aware of a soul spiritual element. You must picture to yourselves what an utterly different experience this was from the way modern human beings experience perception. It meant a very great deal to look on the earth as the body of the divinity, and to see the earth as a member of the great family of the planets of the universe. The people of olden times thought of the whole cosmos as being indwelt by gods. For them, not only the whole earth was indwelt by gods, but the gods dwelt in each and every one of the great planetary bodies, and each and every planetary being. In stone and tree, in river and rock, in cloud and lightning, some spiritual being was revealed. This consciousness was there in wide circles of people on the earth, and this consciousness was intensified in the many forms of the mysteries to be found here and there on earth. Moving forward to the world of Greece, right up to the time when the outer political greatness of Greece sank into a kind of chaos and the power of Macedonia arose, we find a new current flowing into human knowledge. It is what we came to know last time as Aristotelianism, as that which Alexander the Great, from a spiritual aspect, chose to be the mission of his people. When we look at the culmination of the greatness of Greece, on the one hand, and to the fall of Greece and the rise of Macedonia, on the other, we are faced, first of all, with what external history tells us, which is, in reality, a mere legend. But we can also see something else. In the subconsciousness of the deeper thinkers of that time, we perceive an impulse which came from those mysteries to which Aristotle, despite the fact that he never spoke of them outwardly, was very close. They were those mysteries which, in the deepest sense, awakened to full life in their hearers the consciousness that the whole world was a theogony, a divine process of being, and that we see the world in an altogether illusory way if we believe anything else has being in the world other than gods. It is the gods who manifest in the beings and entities of the world. It is the gods who have experiences in the world. It is gods who perform deeds. And what we see as clouds, what we hear as thunder, what we behold as lightning, what we see on earth as rivers and mountains, what we perceive on earth as the realms of the minerals, all these are revelations, expressions of the progressive development of the destinies of the gods hidden behind them. And what appears outwardly as cloud, lightning, thunder, tree and forest, river and mountain, is nothing else but a revelation from out of the omnipresent existence of gods. Just as the human skin reveals the inner soul nature of the human being. And if there are gods everywhere, then, as the pupils of the mysteries were taught in northern Greece, human beings must differentiate between the lesser gods, who are in single nature beings and nature processes, and the greater gods, who manifest as beings of the sun, Mars, and Mercury, and a fourth category, who cannot be made externally visible in an image or a form. Those were the great gods, the great planetary gods, who were presented to humanity in such a way that their gaze was led out into the cosmic expanse to see with their own eyes, to see too with their whole heart what lives in the sun, Mars, and Mercury. Yes, and what lives not only out there, in one little circle in cosmic space, but everywhere in cosmic space, and which above all is connected with humanity. And then, after what I may call a majestic impulse had been awakened in the pupil of the mysteries of northern Greece, in that his gaze was directed out to the planetary spheres, this insight was deepened within him to such an extent that his eye, EYE, was, so to speak, taken hold of by his heart, so that he might see with his soul. Then the pupil understood why three symbolically formed vessels had been placed on the altar before him. Here in Dornach we once introduced a replica of these vessels in a eurythmic performance of Faust. They were presented there exactly as they appeared in the Samothracian mysteries of northern Greece. The important fact, however, was that in their whole symbolic form, these vessels were associated with an act of consecration, an act of sacrifice. A kind of incense was put into them and lighted. And as the smoke rose up, three words, of which we shall speak tomorrow, were uttered with mantric power into this smoke by the father who was celebrating. And there appeared the forms of the three kabiroi. It happened in the following way. The human breath, as it was exhaled, took shape through the mantric word that was spoken, and communicated its form to the ascending, evaporating substance that had been incorporated in the symbolic jars. When the pupil learned in this way to read in the stream of his own breath, to read what the stream of his breath wrote in the smoke, he learned at the same time to read what the mysterious planets said to him from the wide expanses of the cosmos. For now he knew. The form that the first kabiros assumed through the power of the mantric word was the form Mercury had in reality. The form shown by the second kabiros was the real form of Mars, and the form shown by the third kabiros was that of Apollo, the sun. When we look at these fashion plate figures, if you will forgive such plain speaking, such as we see only too often in galleries of later Greek sculpture, and which are so greatly admired only because people have no idea where they have come from, when we direct our gaze to those figures of an Apollo, a Mars, and a Mercury, we must look at them the way Goethe looked at them during his visit to Italy. For then we may acquire some idea of what Greek art really was in the productions that are now lost, lost and destroyed along with so much else in the first centuries of the Christian era, in the frightful devastation which befell those times. If we look penetratingly at those late Greek sculptures, held on the one hand to be so great, and rightly so, because they point to something, but on the other hand wrongly so, because they are mere imitative reproductions. If we look through them back to their origins, then we see that in earlier Greek times, images of what manifested in the sacrificial rites came into being in the very way I have described. In fact, in a much more majestic and magnificent a manner than later on in the Kabiric mysteries of Samothrace. We look back to those times when the mantric word was uttered into the sacrificial smoke, and the real figure of Apollo, Mars, and Mercury appeared. Those were the times when a human being did not say in the abstract, quote, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was a God," close quote. In those times a human being could say something quite different. He could say, quote, "In me the outgoing breath takes shape, and in shaping itself in an ordered way, it manifests as an image of cosmic creating. For it creates for me, out of the sacrificial smoke, forms that are living lines of writing, telling me what the planetary worlds want to say to me. Close quote. When the pupil of the Kabiric Mysteries at Samothrace approached the portals of the places of initiation, then, through the instruction he had received, the feeling came to him, quote, "Now I am entering the place which holds for me the magic rituals of the celebrating father," close quote. For the initiate who celebrated these mysteries was called father. What did the magic power of the celebrating father reveal to the pupil? Through what was laid within the human being by the gods, through the power of speech, the priestly magician and sage wrote into the sacrificial smoke the writing that expressed the secrets of the universe. Thus it was that the pupil, as he approached the portal, said in his heart, quote, "I am entering the place within whose shelter dwells a powerful spirit, within whose shelter dwell the greater gods who unveil on earth the secrets of the universe through sacrificial rites enacted by human beings." Close quote. There, a language was being spoken, and the kind of writing written which appealed not only to the understanding, but to the whole human being. In the Samothracian mysteries, something was still there of a knowledge, which by today has, of course, quite died out. A modern human being is perfectly capable of saying truthfully what a quartz crystal feels like to the touch, or, if you like, a piece of iron or antimony. A person of today can very well say what it feels like to touch hair, the human skin or animal fur, silk or velvet. In the Samothracian mysteries, something was still present that enabled a human being to say truly what gods feel like. For the sense of feeling, the sense of touch, was still able to do what it could do in ancient times, namely feel the spiritual element, touch the gods. The wonderful thing is this, and we must certainly go back to more ancient times if we want virtually to speak of human beings being able to say truly, quote, "I know with my fingertips what the gods feel like to the touch," close quote. In the Samothracian mysteries, however, there was another way of touching the gods. It was as follows. When the priest-magician spoke the words into the sacrificial smoke, when he intoned the words on the exhaled breath, then in the outgoing breath he felt as a human being otherwise feels when he stretches out his hand to touch something. And just as one knows that one touches differently with the fingertips in passing them over different substances, in feeling velvet, silk, cat's fur, or the human skin, the Samothracian priest-magician perceived his outgoing breath as an expression of something coming from himself. He felt it as an organ of touch reaching out toward the smoke. He felt the smoke, and in the smoke he felt the great gods, the Kabiroi, coming toward him. He felt the way the smoke took on form, and how these forms approached the exhaled breath, so that the exhaled breath felt, quote, "Here is something spherical. There is an angularity. There, again, something is catching hold of me," close quote. The whole divine figure of the Kabiros was touched and felt by the breath clothed in the form of the word. In the words issuing from his heart, the Samothracian sage touched the Kabiroi, that is, the greater gods, descending to him in the sacrificial smoke. It was a living interchange between the Logos in the human being and the Logos out in cosmic spaces. As the initiating father led the pupil to the sacrificial altar and taught him step by step how a human being can sense with speech, and as the pupil progressed more and more and achieved for himself this sensing with speech, he eventually reached the stage of inner experience, in which he now had a clear awareness of the composition of the form of Mercury or Hermes, of Apollo, or of Ares or Mars. It was as though his whole consciousness were raised out of his body, as if that which the pupil previously knew as the content of his head were up above his head, as if his heart were located in a new place and had thrust its way up out of his chest into his head. Thus, in the person who had really gone out beyond himself, there arose a knowledge that inwardly formed itself into the words, quote, "Thus do the Kabiroi, the greater gods, will thee," close quote. From that time onward, the pupil knew that Mercury lived in his limbs, the sun in his heart, Mars in his speech. So you see that in ancient times the pupils were by no means presented only with natural processes and beings in the outer world. What was presented to them was neither one-sidedly naturalistic nor one-sidedly moral, but they were given something in which morality and nature flowed into one. This was the chief secret of the Samothracian world, that an awareness was brought to the pupil. Nature is spirit. Spirit is nature. It is in those times which had their last echo in the Samothracian cult of the Kabiroi that the insight originated which brings earthly substances into connection with the heavens. In olden times, when one saw the red-brown mineral with the coppery sheen that we call copper, one could not simply say, as we do today, quote, "That is copper. That is a constituent of the earth," close quote. They could not think of it like that. For the ancients, it was not a constituent of the earth, but the deed of Venus manifesting itself as copper. The earth had only suffered rocks and stones to appear, such as sandstone or chalk, in order to be able to take into her lap what the heavens had planted in the earth. Just as we would not venture today to say of a seed which we have planted in the earth, quote, "This seed has grown out of the earth," close quote. Just as little would one have been able to say in those times if beneath the surface of the earth one had copper ore, quote, "Copper ore is a constituent of the earth," close quote. One had to say, quote, "The earth with its sandstone or any other stone is the ground within which the metals have been planted by the planets. The metal is a seed planted in the earth by a planet," close quote. Everything on earth was seen to be sent into the earth by the heavens. Today, when you learn about the earth and its substances, you will see in any mineralogical or geological textbook that only the earth is described. It would never have been done in this way in the science of the ancients. In those times when a human being let his gaze wander over the earth and saw the substances there, he had to look up to heaven, for there he beheld the essence and reality of the substance. Copper, tin, and lead only appear to lie in the earth. They are really the seeds planted during the old sun epoch and moon epoch by the heavens into the earth. This was still the way the Kabiroi taught in the Samothracian mysteries, and this it was, ultimately, that worked upon Aristotle and Alexander, if only as an atmosphere or mood of knowledge. And then a beginning was made for something quite different. Humanity did not, with regard to their insight, come right down at once onto the earth, but went through an intermediary stage in ancient times. Even in the echoes of those ancient times, namely the Samothracian mysteries, when it was a matter of describing metals or any other earthly substances, such as sulfur or phosphorus, they actually described the heavens, just as one describes a plant when one wants to know the nature of a seed. If you have a grain of seed in front of you, you cannot recognize the kind of seed it is if you do not know the plant. What would you make of a grain of seed which looks like this, if you did not know what the aniseed plant looks like? Quote, "What would you make of the copper which appears in the earth?" close quote, the people of old would have asked. Quote, "If you did not know what Venus looks like in spirit, soul, and body, up there in the heavens," close quote. The knowledge of the heavens gradually turned into a knowledge of the atmosphere, so that when people looked at an earthly formation, they now no longer described the stars and their beings, but said, quote, "There lives in it in the first place what we see in the solid earth. Then there also lives in it the quality of fluid, which has the tendency to form drops, and there lives in it, too, something of an aeriform nature, which tends to spread out in every direction, and which lives in the human organism, in the breath, and in speech. And it also has living within it the fiery element which dissolves separate being, so that from the cleft and scattered parts something new may arise. The elements live in every earthly formation." And just as in earlier ages, in the ancient mysteries, human beings looked on the substance salt, which, although also of cosmic origin, had been shaped and molded into an earthly substance, and regarded it as the ground into which Mother Earth receives the metals, they regarded as mercury everything that came from the cosmos with the destiny of becoming a metal. It is really so utterly childish to try to give it descriptions, as people do nowadays, of what was thought of as mercury in medieval times. Persistently in the background is the idea that by mercury, even in the Middle Ages, something like quicksilver or some kind of single metal is meant. This is not the case. Mercury is every metal, insofar as it is under the influence of the whole cosmos. For what would happen to copper if the periphery of the cosmos alone worked upon it? Copper would be globular, like quicksilver. If the cosmos alone affected it, what would lead become? Lead would become globular, like quicksilver. What of tin, if it were affected only by the cosmos? Tin would be globular. Every metal, if affected only by the cosmos, would be quicksilver. All metals are mercury insofar as the cosmos acts upon them. But what of mercury, the actual present-day mercury, which still takes on globular form on Earth? What is that? I will tell you. The other metals, let us say lead, copper, tin, or iron, have progressed beyond the globular form. While the whole Earth was still under the influence of the spherical cosmos, all metals were mercurial. They have now progressed beyond the mercurial form, and nowadays they crystallize into other forms. Only actual quicksilver, in the present-day sense of the word, has remained at that stage. What would the ancient alchemists have said of modern quicksilver, and what, in fact, did the medieval alchemists say of it? They said, quote, "Copper, tin, iron, and lead are the good metals that have progressed with providence. Quicksilver is the Lucifer among the metals, for it has remained at an earlier stage." Close quote. That is how it was in earlier times. When they spoke about earthly things in this way, they were in fact speaking of the heavenly aspect. They went on from this to speaking of what exists between the encircling round and the earth, namely the earth itself. Below, then, the watery element, the element of air, and the element of fire. Thus the ancients saw everything on the earth from the point of view of the heavens, and the people of the Middle Ages, which did not come to an end until the first third of the 14th century, saw everything from the point of view of the surrounding atmosphere. Then in the 14th and 15th centuries came the great turning point. The human being and his outlook fell right down onto the earth. And now, with regard to his consciousness, the elements of water, air, and fire were broken down and split up into sulfur, carbon, hydrogen. Human beings saw everything from the earthly point of view. This was the beginning of the time I mentioned when describing the Hibernian mysteries, the time when human beings spanned the earth with their knowledge, and the heavens became a matter of mathematics. Human beings calculate the size of the stars, their movements, their distance, and so on. The heavens became an abstraction. Nor was it only the heavens that became an abstraction. In the living human being, his head is a likeness of the heavens, and what human beings can know of the heavens is in their heads. And since the only knowledge human beings have had of the heavens has been by way of mathematics, that is, the element of logic and abstraction, there now lives in their heads this element only, abstract logic, the realm of concepts and ideas. From this time on, there was no way in which human beings could include the spiritual element in their concepts and ideas. And when they looked for the spirit, that great struggle began between what a human being could attain by way of the ideas in his head, in his brain, and what the gods wished to reveal to him from the heavens. This struggle was fought out at its fiercest and in its grandest aspects in Rosicrucianism, in the true forms of what are called the Rosicrucian mysteries in the Middle Ages. There the helplessness of modern humanity was perceived as a preparation for true knowledge. For indeed, in the circles of true Rosicrucian initiation, something very powerful made itself felt, and it was this. The pupil became, not abstractly but inwardly, illumined to perceive. As a modern human being, you can penetrate only to the world of ideas. Thereby, however, you lose the living being of this your humanity. And the pupil felt that what the New Age was giving him could not lead him to the essence of his real being. He felt either you must despair of knowledge, or you must go through a kind of mortification of the arrogance of abstraction. The Rosicrucian pupil, the true Rosicrucian pupil, felt as though his master had given him a blow on the back of his neck to indicate to him that the abstractions of the modern brain are not suited to entering the spiritual worlds, and that he must renounce mere abstraction to enter them. That was indeed a tremendous preparatory moment for what we may call the Rosicrucian initiation. The end of Lecture 12.